You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Mel, I apologize for sending you the wrong Riverside link. We were both just waiting in separate Riverside rooms for 10 minutes. That's on me.
No problem. Understood.
As I was just saying, you were last on earlier this year, probably end of June. We published our conversation on July 2nd, which was a little over a week before the first assassination attempt on Donald Trump's life. A lot has happened between the end of June and today. Obviously, Trump won the presidency in resounding fashion. He has a mandate and won the popular vote, Electoral College. Republicans have the House and the Senate. And we're in this lame duck period where Trump is building his administration, his committees, putting people in places to effectuate that mandate, which he seems to have. And a lot of people have a lot of theories about where things are going, including you. And it seems like you may think that things are not going to go as many people think the plans are right now. So thanks for coming back on the show and really interested to catch up.
Yeah, definitely. Appreciate you having me. There certainly has been a lot going on. And yeah, like we talked briefly before hitting record there, I think there's a lot of things that both market participants, media, general population are kind of seeing as coming down the pike. And I think maybe some of it will happen. I think some of it won't. And I think we will see a lot of things that are not going to be expected. I think big picture, we're going to see bigger changes and bigger fights and bigger stories than most people are anticipating. And that's a pretty high bar to cross because I think a lot of people are expecting big change. But what I'm talking about is substantial change to the monetary system, substantial changes to the interactions between the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, big changes with dollar, gold, Bitcoin, just geopolitical events that really we haven't seen these type of things since probably post-World War II time period.
What's leading you to believe this? You sent me an email yesterday. I think topics that we should probably cover that would dive into your thesis, tariffs, Scott Bessent as Secretary of the Treasury, and as you alluded to, the potential for the Fed's the way the Fed operates to change structurally under a Trump administration.
Yeah. Well, I think starting with Scott Bessent is kind of a good place to start because he's a very interesting individual. I think there was a tweet when the decision was still being made, Elon put out seeing him as a business as usual pick. And after really researching him, reading about him, listening to almost every podcast I could find on him where he speaks his views and his gives his life story and all that stuff, I think he's a lot more imaginative and a lot more risk tolerant, more of a risk taker than people realize. And I think he has some very clear views about central bank treasury interactions that you can trace back to his thesis on one of his biggest trades, which was really to go short the yen when Abe took over in Japan. You know, he was involved in some really historic trades. He was involved on kind of a peripheral level when Soros broke the pound and it moved outside of its established trading range. Back then, you know, the pound traded vis-a-vis other currencies in a very regulated fashion through something called the exchange rate mechanism, kind of a holdover from IMF currency manipulation days post Bretton Woods. And when Abe took over, who he, I think, really admired, and has fashioned himself after a little bit. Abe famously had his three arrows. He had his 2-2-2 plan, which was 2% inflation, 2% growth in 2 years. Bessin has come out with a 3-3-3 plan, 3% deficits, 3% growth, 3 million more barrels of oil or oil equivalents. And so one of the things in these many podcasts and interviews that Bessin likes to talk about is what really got him over the edge to being willing to jump into this short yen trade was the way the appointment calendars were set up. He saw that Abe was going to have a chance to remake the board of the Bank of Japan. He was going to essentially be able to appoint a bunch of governors and a central bank chief that would carry out his policies. I think that the Treasury and some of these policies that the Trump administration wants to put in, on one level, they seem kind of contradictory, right? So it's like, we want to really cut the government, but we want the economy to truly grow. And in the long term, cutting government spending definitely is a good thing for growth. But in the short term, it takes a while for the economy to change. If you just chop off, you know, $500 billion worth of government spending, that in many ways goes directly to GDP. And in some sense, there's even a multiplier to government spending. And Trump does not want the stock market to go down. He doesn't want a recession. He doesn't want unemployment levels to go up. And so to kind of square all of those circles, I think the only way that's really possible is by going back to things that we haven't done since the 1940s, 1950s, things like yield curve control, things where the Treasury is much more involved with monetary policy than historically it has been. And so we could get into a little bit of that history, because I think that kind of sheds light on it. But I think then that also leads into different ramifications, and it leads into what will eventually happen, which I think is going to be some sort of a, you know, volatile period for markets in the first half probably of next year, where people try to figure out where is all of this stuff going to land. I think ultimately it's going to land in a good place, but there's going to be a lot of feathers that get ruffled along the way.
Yeah, let's jump into the history lesson, because actually it's funny that you bring up 1940s policy, because that's something that I think Lynn Alden has been banging the drum about for a couple years, is a lot of people have been anchoring this period of high inflation and using the parallel of 1970s inflation as the parallel that we should be drawing conclusions from. But Lynn has been banging the drum saying, no, it's more like the 1940s. And so really interested to hear your perspective on the lessons from that era, which many people seem to gloss over.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating time, and it's a time that Scott Bessin's very familiar with. So one of the interesting things about him, he's very much into economic and financial history. When he took kind of a career break, he went as his job to go teach economic history at Yale. I think he still has been doing that even while he's been doing his company, I think Key Square. So he's very much aware of this, more so than, you know, just a normal kind of hedge fund guy might be. So basically in the 1940s, right, we had a similar situation where we had debt to GDP 120%, something like that. World War II ends, and, you know, a bunch of people come home. The demand, you know, for goods, services just kind of skyrockets, and you had massive inflation. You had, you know, double-digit inflation in 46, 47. But you also had this desire by the government to keep interest rates low. And so you can kind of see a little bit of parallels already with what some economists are talking about with Trump policies, is that some of these have inflationary tendencies. But at the same time, we know Trump has also hinted he wants a weaker dollar. We know he's not going to want interest rates, you know, going up to have 10% mortgages, which people would be up in arms about. So the way you kind of, again, square that circle is you look back to parallels in history. How did we achieve that, say, in the 1940s? And we did it with yield curve control, which was basically controlling not just the short end. Obviously, the Federal Reserve can set short-term rates, but also controlling the long end and capping out Treasury bond yields at 2.5% for quite a number of years, actually. It started back in World War II, and it continued post-World War II, where Treasury and the Fed, through open market actions, were essentially buying Treasury bonds, keeping yields down at 2.5%, and they kept the short-term rate at 3/8, so near zero. So you had this really nice sloping yield curve from 3/8 on the short end to 2.5. It was very stable. Everybody knew that's what the rates were going to be. And obviously, you know, for long-term bondholders, you know, that wasn't a great situation when you're having 10, 12, 15% inflation and you're getting 2.5 on a bond, but that was the price to be paid. And I think that's the price that's going to be paid in coming years is long-term bondholders losing out. And, you know, I'm not the only one to say that. A lot of people, Luke Groman, I'm sure Lynn Alden probably has talked about this a little bit. You know, Luke Groman likes to say, you know, they're the suckers at the card table. I tend to agree with that. And I think what's going to happen is, you know, again, you go back to those 40s, 50s period, there was a lot more direct control that the Treasury had. And the Federal Reserve just did not like all this monkeying. And there was something, it was 1951 or 1952, there was a meeting where Truman called in leaders from the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and basically said, you know, you guys need to get together. And it became known as the Treasury-Fed Accord of 1951 or 1952. I forget exactly. But very early 50s, because things were starting to get a little bit out of hand with all the war spending going on at that time with Korea. So basically what happened was at that time, there was a little bit more of a delineation put in between the Fed to control monetary policy and the Treasury still got control of the dollar. The Fed has, certain mechanisms. I mean, the Treasury has certain mechanisms that still allow it to manipulate the dollar. They have a special fund with special drawing rights and U.S. dollars in it that they pull out during financial crisis in 2008, they did in 2020 to stabilize currencies, but they've generally stayed out of monetary policy. And I think to truly affect the Trump policies in a way that doesn't tank the stock market, tank the real economy, you're going to need some of these monetary controls, which eventually lead to weaker dollar, higher asset prices, stocks, and especially things like, you know, Bitcoin and possibly gold as well.
Sup, freaks. This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at BitKey. BitKey makes Bitcoin easy to use and hard to lose. It is a hardware wallet that natively embeds into a 2 or 3 multi-sig. You have one key on the hardware wallet, one key on your mobile device, and Block stores a key in the cloud for you. This is an incredible hardware device for your friends and family, or maybe yourself who have Bitcoin on exchanges and have for a long time, but haven't taken the step to self-custody because they're worried about the complications of setting up a private public key pair, securing that seed phrase, setting up a PIN, setting up a passphrase. Again, BitKey makes it easy to use, hard to lose. It's the easiest 0-to-1 step, your first step to self-custody. If you have friends and family on the exchanges who haven't moved it off, tell them to pick up a BitKey. Go to bitkey.world, use the key TFTC20 at checkout for 20% off your order. That's bitkey.world, code TFTC20. This rip is also brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. CoinKite builds the best Bitcoin hardware in the world. There is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. If you're looking to secure and self-custody your Bitcoin, you can get the MK4 or the ColdCard Q. ColdCard Q has a full keyboard, a QR scanner, NFC enabled, has a battery pack. Put some AA batteries in there. Create private public keys off pair in an air gap fashion. Private keys never have to touch an online device. They have their Sats card, which is the best way to give Bitcoin. If you're looking to gift Bitcoin for a wedding, a birthday party, a communion, a bar mitzvah, whatever it may be, tap the card on the back of your phone. You get a address to send to. You send it to that address. It lives on the Sats card. Again, there is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. The Bitcoin price seems to be going up. You want to take care of your security before Bitcoin goes to six figures. Make sure you get your Bitcoin off exchanges using CoinKite hardware, MK4, ColdCard Q. Go to CoinKite.com. Use the code TFTC. We have a code now, TFTC, for 5% off at checkout. This would make sense considering Trump's posturing over the last year, because I think he's explicitly come out and said that he'd like to control the Fed's fund rate if possible. So it seems like he's put Scott Bessent in this position with the knowledge that he has and the experience that he has, particularly around currency trades, whether it's the yen or the speculative attack on the pound when he was at the Soros Fund. So is this a confirmation of the signaling he's been doing for the better part of a year? Because if they are going to go out and attempt to execute this policy, that there is a needle to thread, I would imagine.
Yes, I think there's a very small needle to thread. If anybody could do it, I think, you know, this team would have a chance. And I think it was not surprising to me that the Treasury pick was one that Trump seemed to agonize over, seemed to have some difficulty eventually coming to a final decision on. And I think that it's, of all the picks, it's the most important, you know, pick for his White House. I think there's also a chance, although I'm not sure if this would happen, where he could eventually want to slot Bessent in to lead the Federal Reserve at the end of Powell's term, if not sooner, if not challenge the Supreme Court ruling that the Fed chair cannot be removed by the president. I think that's still unclear whether that's the case. But you're absolutely right. Trump has said, you know, maybe the president shouldn't be setting the Fed's funds rate, but essentially should have a voice at the table, a voice at the FOMC, the Fed Open Market Committee that sets rates. He's talked about greater involvement during his previous term. He jawboned a lot. He talked a lot more about, you know, Federal Reserve, openly criticizing Federal Reserve for keeping rates too high. And so you have this willingness. And this goes back to Bessent, some of those podcasts. He talks a lot. He tells stories about his father having the largest science fiction library in the state of South Carolina and really being into kind of imagination. That one of Bessent's favorite lines in these podcasts is to tell people he could find Alpha Centauri in the sky long before he could find Chicago on a map, because he's always kind of been this dreamer, but in this kind of financial guy's, you know, body and life. And he's also, I believe, a patriotic guy. He was admitted to the Naval Academy, but he felt at the time, given the policy against homosexuals, that it wasn't right for him to go into the military, given he was gay. And he's often looked for ways to serve. And one of the most telling things I saw in these podcasts was a Manhattan Institute interview he did about 5 months ago, where he literally, for like a minute straight, starts talking about the need for a new Bretton Woods, something along the lines of a monetary restructuring like we had after World War I, like happened as the result of the Treaty of Versailles after World War I, like we had at Bretton Woods after World War II, and that we needed a massive monetary reset. And he was very specific. We needed it in the next administration. He says, in the next 4 years, we're going to need a massive monetary reset, and I want to be a part of it. And so I think that pretty much he's telling you that he wants to be involved in remaking a new global monetary system. And this goes right back to my opening, where I think the level of changes that people are bracing for is huge, but it's actually going to go even higher than that, that we're going to have all kinds of discussions, rumors, massive changes to institutions in ways that a lot of people might have seen as kind of sacrosanct. You can't do that. You can't mess with Fed independence, or you'll roil the markets. And I think that Fed independence is going to be threatened. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I've been on podcasts in the past where I've talked about the Federal Reserve. You know, there's an argument to be made that it should be abolished. I think that's such a drastic move that you don't need to abolish it, but you need to realign the incentives of the Federal Reserve system with the needs of the American people. And I think right now the Federal Reserve system operates as kind of a proxy for the large banks, which at the end of the day are the owners on the cap tables of the Federal Reserve, branch banks. So if you look at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, there are shares of that entity that are owned by Citigroup, JP Morgan, Bank of America. And so, you know, basically we have this Federal Reserve System that parades around as if they're acting in the interests of the American people. And I'm not impugning Jerome Powell as a person, but I think the institution itself is not set up to serve the American people. And you have to understand why central banks were set up in the first place, because when money was gold, the government actually needed physical gold. And so the central bank was set up as a way to funnel gold from wealthy individuals, from banks, to the government when the government needed gold to finance wars and different things. And so the bank was set up to serve these interests of the banks because it was their gold that was being lent to the government. We now have a situation in this fiat world where that whole apparatus is no longer necessary. You know, the federal government has no need to go to JP Morgan in order to issue treasury bonds. They're still using JP Morgan and JP Morgan's balance sheet to hold treasury bonds, but it's a bit of a facade rather than an actual case of where physical gold needed to be transferred from JP Morgan's balance sheet to the Federal Reserve, to the Federal Reserve, to the Treasury. And so we've got all of these things going on, and there are good reasons why now is the time to make these changes, not the least of which is what's going on with BRICS, which we know is also on Trump's radar.
Well, that perfect setup, alley-oop to the next question I had is Scott Bessent being in the position that he is, it seems like Trump recognizing that we need structural change. Is it just that, like a recognition that we are operating in this late stage of the fiat monetary system set up over 100 years ago when the Fed was put into place, and it's a recognition that it's sort of gotten out of hand. It's this Frankenstein that is out of control and we need to rein it in. And people have been throwing around the word soft landing in the context of Fed policy in recent years, but this truly seems like the way you're describing it, like Scott Bessent, the Trump administration trying to manufacture this soft landing to a new monetary order. Or is it simply interested parties saying this isn't working in the interest of the American people? We need to bring in a new system. If left alone, that system could persist, but we don't like it nonetheless, and we want to create this new one.
Yeah, I actually don't know if left alone the system could persist. I think that it's actually much more of a dire situation than anybody's going to tell you on from the Federal Reserve or the Treasury or even on mass media, you know, that you're not going to hear, you know, CNBC, which is backed by Morgan Stanley and JP Morgan and BlackRock. You know, none of these people have in their interest to be honest with the American people about the real situation. And, you know, the spike in deficits and deficits to GDP that we've experienced is huge. And, you know, it's also happened or come to be that at these levels, there's really a massive threat to financial stability if there's even the slightest hint of a significant pullback in the real economy or a recession. So, for example, in 2022, we did not have massive unemployment, but we did have a stock market sell-off. And that sell-off alone cost the Treasury over $500 billion in receipts in 2023. Because of lack of capital gains taxes coming into the government. And so the government has gotten itself pretty much in a Ponzi scheme type situation, like a la Bernie Madoff, where Bernie Madoff, everything is great as long as the stock market's going up. He can pull money from one client and give it to another. But when the stock market crashed in 08, you know, and people wanted their money, all of a sudden it comes crashing down. And we've gotten ourselves into that type of a situation where we don't have 60 or 70% of debt to GDP anymore. We have 120% debt to GDP. We have 6% deficits. We spent $1 trillion on interest last year. And the projection is for that to be, you know, closer to $1.5 trillion or higher next year, given that in 2025, there's something like $6 or $7 trillion in treasury notes and bonds that are rolling over that need to be refinanced. So not only the issuance to fund the deficit, which will probably be around $2 trillion again, but also, you know, you've got to refinance $6 or $7 trillion, and most of that is at much lower rates than what the market's at right now. So, you know, I went through the latest fiscal year report from the Treasury, fiscal year ended September 30th for 2024, and I just added up defense spending, interest, Social Security, Medicare, and I included veterans benefits in that as well. And you get to 86-87% of federal spending. If you cut out the entire rest of the government, it's less than $1 trillion. So, you know, like some of these things with Doge talking about, oh, we could probably cut $2 trillion. Even if you completely got rid of every single government department and office, Department of Justice, you know, agriculture, interior, you get rid of them all, you don't even cut off $1 trillion from the deficit. That's how much of our spending is in interest, entitlements, defense, and VA benefits. And so the only way that you can, you know, cut some spending, I think, is there is waste, fraud, and abuse in the system. There are government departments that are overfunded, overemployed. I think it's realistic to think $200-300 billion could possibly be chopped off of the federal spending. But nowhere in any world can I see the magnitude of cuts that some people are expecting to eventually come. And so what that means is that we're still going to operate at a deficit. Even Bessent says his goal is to get to a 3% deficit by 2028. So he's basically telling you he expects the government to operate at 4, 5, 6% deficits for the entire Trump administration. And then by 2028, we'll be at 3. And that's if his plan goes according, if everything goes according to plan. And so we have this situation where the amount of, and then I could add on other things on top of that, like the amount of Treasury issuance that Yellen funded with T-bills, you know, and this leads into stable coins. This leads into the bigger picture replacement of the monetary system. You know, there's other people, again, who have talked about this, where you need something to inflate to back the debt of the United States. And in the 70s, we did oil, and now we could do Bitcoin, we could do gold. I think that's an idea, you know, Luke Groman has put forward. I think you could almost even take that idea one step further and see how it could be possible to essentially attack the BRIC system, which is currently being based on gold, by inflating Bitcoin, buying Bitcoin in a strategic reserve, and funding those purchases with the sale of U.S. gold stockpiles. I'm not necessarily in favor of that. In fact, I'm a longtime precious metal holder. But you can see kind of the game theory involved of let the BRICS build up their system, Russia, China spending all this money on gold, and then the largest known holder of gold at over 8,000 metric tons, over 260 million ounces, starts to sell it into the market. How that collapses the gold price to buy Bitcoin, inflates the Bitcoin, which then has, you know, the beginnings of becoming a monetary base. Now, whether or not that's going to happen, I don't know, but it's one scenario that I think you can lay out there that, again, is a bigger change than what people are imagining right now.
This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores. Connect your wallets or custodial accounts and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC. $40 off. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Salt of the Earth. You got to be hydrating, freaks. And while you're hydrating, you got to be getting your electrolytes. This is the best electrolytes mix that I've ever come into contact with. Pink Himalayan salt with calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, no sugar. It tastes incredible. My favorite is the orange and the pink lemonade. Go to drinksote.com. That's drinksote.com. Use the code TFTC when you make your purchase and you'll get 15% off. I'm telling you, get on it, freaks. You're going to love this stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, from what I'm hearing, it seems like the Trump administration is very gung-ho about this Bitcoin strategic reserve. And I'm headed over to Abu Dhabi next week for the Bitcoin MENA conference. And the rumors behind this, I mean, people are talking about this publicly on Twitter. So I feel comfortable saying it here in this conversation, but people are pretty confident that there will be some announcements about Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds that are allocating to Bitcoin too. And it does seem like with the Trump victory and his upcoming second term that Bitcoin is going to play a role, which is insane to me. If you were to tell me this only a year ago, I would have thought you were crazy. However, it seems like we're here. And when you put it that way, in terms of using Bitcoin as a strategic asset, not only to bolster the treasury, but to use it as a tool to weaken a BRICS coalition that seems pretty dead set on competing with the dollar reserve system. It makes a lot of sense. And I guess the question is, as it pertains to Bitcoin, do you think Russia, China, and it seems obvious that the Middle East, who seems to be playing both sides of the fence at all times due to the way the international oil and gas markets operate, simply just where they sit in the stratosphere of the game theory, that they could be seeing what's happening here in the United States and saying, crap, do we have to hedge our bets and get exposure to Bitcoin as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you could. I mean, you can see and envision a path where there's these two systems, one backed with the monetary base being Bitcoin and one with gold. And, you know, to put some numbers around this, I pulled out, you know, Federal Reserve numbers of U.S. gold holdings, took a look at what that total supply is, and it's not as big as you think. I think it's 261 million ounces at $2,600 an ounce. It's somewhere in the $600 billion range. So if you start doing the math and you take a look at the Bitcoin Act by Senator Loomis, she talks about in that act buying 200,000 Bitcoin a year for 5 years. If you want to try to finance that, you know, that's what, $20 billion a year. It's pretty easy to sell a little bit of gold into that and buy Bitcoin at, say, 100,000 a coin. But if you announce that you're going to start selling U.S. gold into the gold market, what's that going to do to the gold price when the biggest holder announces they're liquidating a large portion of their assets? It's going to drive down the gold price. And when you at the same time say they're going to buy Bitcoin, it's going to raise the Bitcoin price. And so you very quickly get to a point where the Bitcoin price skyrockets, gold price plummets, and it's not actually that easy to finance the strategic reserve simply by selling off a small portion of the gold holdings. You almost have to liquidate the entire U.S. gold holdings in order to fund the Bitcoin holdings. And so I actually don't think that that's the end result, or that will be the end result. But even whispers of something like that in the system, again, it starts playing into people saying, huh, like a Saudi Arabia is a perfect example. We want to have relationships with China. We want to do trade. We're going to do yuan and Saudi reales with them. But at the same time, we are going to need net settle in gold. So we want the gold price to be stable. But if the U.S. starts unloading gold and just buying up on Bitcoin, we better get our hands on a little bit of Bitcoin. And you start off these things that from the outside, like you said, 2-3 years ago, sound crazy. But you start saying, oh, wow, Western central banks that want to align with the United States system are going to also now need to start buying Bitcoin. And all of a sudden, you know, it just starts off this spiral. And then the same thing on the gold side, you know, the biggest holders of gold are still a lot of these Western central banks like France, Germany, Italy has a huge amount, obviously Switzerland, you know. And so I think getting all those people on board of dumping gold to buy Bitcoin is not going to happen. But that doesn't mean, in the same way that Trump might use tariffs, you know, big tariffs as negotiating tactics, that doesn't mean that Trump claiming he's going to finance a Bitcoin strategic reserve by selling gold, that can have effects even if the gold doesn't eventually get sold. And so I think you have all of these geopolitical moves in the air that would just, you know, completely upend the system and ultimately cause volatility. And that's why I do think, you know, there's going to be a lot more volatility in financial assets, in the stock market, in the treasury market, in the first 6 months of the Trump administration, because all of these, this whole stew of all of these ideas is going to come out in one way or another, whether it's leaks or whether it's truths on Truth Social or tweets or whatever way these massive changes are going to start floating out into Wall Street Journal reports, and financial markets are going to start reacting to them. And I think it's actually, you know, bullish for gold and Bitcoin, because I think gold will be that asset that's not, you know, financial assets. And Bitcoin obviously has its things. And I know that sounds a little contradictory, Mel. You're saying it's going to be good for gold, because I think at a certain point, while it could cause gold sell-offs, people will start to realize, well, wait a minute, if the BRICS really institute this system, it needs to be a lot more than $2,500 an ounce, even if the U.S. isn't playing along. And so if gold's going to truly become a monetary metal again, which is the basis of a monetary system for half of the world's population, half of the world's GDP, it needs to be a lot higher than 2,000. It needs to be closer to 20,000, 30,000. Doesn't mean that the U.S. selling gold in the short term doesn't cause a gold drop, but once people realize where gold's going to need to end up if it's truly going to become the monetary base, and if Bitcoin's truly going to become the monetary base for the Western world, well, I mean, that's where you start getting into, you know, I did some calculations somewhere around the $25 million mark. Now that sounds crazy, but it's based on an assumption of around 1,000 trillion in global wealth. And if you wanted to back that, half of that with 21 million Bitcoin, you're at about that $23-24 million coin mark. And so do I think that's going to happen overnight, or we're going to these sort of levels in the next 4 years? No. But if people start saying, wow, there is a really, truly significant adoption of Western central banks of Bitcoin as a reserve asset, it starts us on that path where in 20, 30, 40 years, if it truly becomes the monetary base, this is where we're going to end up with it. And the same thing goes for gold. If gold is going to represent the other half of the world's wealth, my calculation is it needs to get to somewhere in the 50 to 60,000 an ounce category. So the bottom line is that creating a new global monetary system, not based on fiat, not based on the unlimited potential for governments to spend money so fruitlessly that you eventually get massive inflation, you know, negative returns on investment, losses in buying power. If you want to avoid all of that and you say, okay, we had this experiment from 1971 to 2024 where we were on a pure fiat world. We saw it wound up with $330 trillion in global debt. It wound up with massive inflation. It wound up with bloated socialist-like governments. And the way to avoid that is to have a neutral reserve asset that can't be printed, and you go with gold or you go with Bitcoin or a combination. I see no way that these assets don't settle significantly higher.
Do you see a scenario in which, instead of splitting into two different reserve assets serving two different parts of the world, where you have a coalescence around one, like Bitcoin? I'm just thinking, I mean, that's one of the ideas that's talked a lot about in Bitcoin, or one of the theories, is that the gold standard failed due to the physical nature forcing the physical centralization. of the asset as the economy grows, as population grows, and you have so much wealth that needs to be represented in this very scarce physical asset and gold, it just becomes very, very hard to scale. Whereas with Bitcoin, since it's digital, extremely divisible, you can send it over the internet, it's much better suited to facilitate the amount of economic activity that's simply happening on the planet today. Like, is there a scenario in which both sides, the Western part of the world and the Eastern part of the world, wake up to this fact and coalesce around Bitcoin as opposed to gold?
Well, I think, you know, that problem with gold about, you know, easy to send around and so on, it might be a little overstated, right? I mean, the central banks would hold the gold at the Federal Reserve, or they'd hold it in Switzerland, or they'd hold it at the Bank of England. And the BIS would monitor this, the Bank for International Settlements, the Central Bank for Central Banks based in Basel, Switzerland. And they would do the accounting to transfer, you know, gold from India to the United States or vice versa. And then the actual, you know, transaction mechanism of these currencies, which was backed by gold, was, you know, divisible into dollars and pennies and dimes. And you could do ledger accounting and do things so that, you know, money was being moved more or less instantaneously without physically trucking the gold from one place to another. That had its issues, but, you know, it seemed to suffice at least. I think a lot of people were really upset with the gold standard during the Depression because they couldn't increase the money supply, right? They couldn't take that gold and say, you know, we have a lot of money, because gold in the U.S. was pegged at $20 an ounce. And that was why, you know, FDR confiscated gold in 1933. That was why he immediately revalued it to $35 an ounce and therefore, you know, increased the money supply, you know, $15 out of on a $20 base. That's a 75% increase in the money supply overnight with the gold revaluation. And so I think if you have Bitcoin or you have gold as that monetary base, there's always that potential to revalue it, right? There's always that way where, you know, we just had a global pandemic and we need to increase the money supply. And the way that happens is you have a you're actually benefiting from having a difference between the reserve asset and the transactional asset. So the transactional asset, what people get paid in, what they buy stuff with, can be devalued and increase the money supply in a time of, you know, global financial emergency. But at the same time, savers that own the gold or own the Bitcoin don't get devalued away, which is what happened in 2020, right? So we had a global pandemic. We basically needed to print trillions and trillions of dollars around the world. No government wanted to tax people trillions and trillions of dollars and say, we're going to take 15% of everybody's net worth. Instead, what they did was they just printed the money and through inflation took 20-25% of everybody's net worth in order to pay for the COVID response. And so you hurt the savers, but you did get the money supply increase. If you have a neutral reserve asset that can't be counterfeited, printed, and you need to expand the money supply, it's beneficial to have a transaction asset and a reserve asset separated so that you can essentially revalue that transaction asset. And not be hurting savers that want to maintain their purchasing power.
Interesting. And so how do you see this playing out come inauguration, end of January? Trump gets in, hopefully, you know, it seems very likely since we have the Republicans have the House and the Senate that or at least a lot of his appointments get confirmed into their positions. What do you think the order of operations, particularly from the Treasury, is to begin enacting this policy to thread this needle?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to have Doge come up with cuts, and some of the exuberance and enthusiasm for those, I think, you know, Elon might find out it's harder to make big cuts in Washington than put rocket ships on Mars. But basically, we're going to have, I think, Bessent as the puppet master of all of this behind the scenes, whether it's a new financial system, managing, cutting the deficit at least somewhat without tanking the economy and the stock market, and then, you know, starting to essentially put together the frameworks and the channels for this global reordering. I think at some point it is going to require a summit, something G20, maybe bigger. Maybe some members will refuse to go because they want to, you know, be in a BRICS summit. But it's, I think there's a good chance for an actual formal monetary summit, the likes of which we haven't seen since Bretton Woods, which was exactly 80 years ago, this past July, in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, where people got together specifically to create the new monetary system post World War II. And so, where does this all end up? So I've tried to lay out different scenarios, things that I think are within the realm of possibility, but of course, I don't know. You know, I wish I did know exactly, you know, this is the path that I see has to happen. I think there's so many moving parts in it, but I do think, going back to the beginning, that the monetary situation is more acute and more dangerous and more fragile and more precarious than any of the big parties want you to know. It's the same type of a situation in 2007 when you had Federal Reserve governors coming out and saying the mortgage crisis is contained. Don't worry, this isn't going to spill over into the real economy. We've got it under control. And lo and behold, what happened? And so I think you've got people saying, look, you know, Powell says the debt level's not unsustainable, but our trajectory is unsustainable. That's his go-to statement for it. I think that we're getting close to a point where even the debt levels are getting unsustainable. And I think, especially if interest rates continue to rise, you know, given the interest expense. And so we're at that crisis point. And so what I do see definitely coming within the next 1 to 2 years is a major crisis point. A crisis point that creates a lot of volatility, that creates a lot of some of the ideas I've been talking about getting out there into the ether and really scaring different financial players, participants, markets, sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, insurance companies, people getting scared. And then coming out of that, some sort of a pragmatic solution that I think actually Bessent has been training his whole life to kind of orchestrate, like, you know, cometh the hour, cometh the man type situation where, you know, the world is at a point where it's becoming household knowledge now, things that, you know, I used to research and study and talk about, you know, years ago, uncontrollable debts, entitlements are going bankrupt. You know, we're turning into a banana republic with our spending. You can't trust the purchasing power of the dollar. All these things that Bitcoiners and other people have known for years and years are starting to enter the household vernacular. And we're coming to this point. And I think that's what's going to happen. And exactly how that turns out, I don't know. But I do think Bitcoin and gold will be a part of it. It could be that people start to realize, hey, you know, U.S. is still going to do some trading with China and BRICS nations, and they're going to need and want to hold gold as a reserve asset for that. But that Bitcoin's also going to come in and serve as a reserve asset for those countries that want to start buying into that kind of mechanism. Who knows? Central banks could say, you know what, we like the idea of Bitcoin. We're going to create a blockchain, triple ledger, you know, hard cap digital asset that's going to be a central bank digital asset, like a special drawing right that the IMF created. You know, I think there are problems with that. But I do think there's just so many of these big unknowns that there's no way that once these things start getting talked about in the open and in the Wall Street Journal and on CNBC and Fox Business, that they're going to roil markets. And so I think that Trump's inclination to keep the stock market going, keep you know, the economy at full employment, is going to lead him to do things that heretofore have been thought unthinkable, like significantly change the mandate and interactions of the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, break that 1951 Treasury-Fed Accord, and have government much more involved with monetary policy, and yield curve controls, these types of situations, maybe even capital controls on dollar exports. And so all of these things, I think, are kind of on their way. And it's really going to be a pivotal time, probably, like I said, the greatest monetary shakeup since, you know, 1944 is coming in the next 12 to 36 months.
In terms of breaking the Fed Treasury Accord, what do you see being the potential mechanism to make that happen? An executive order, a bill that President Trump sort of puts into the ether and somebody from the House puts forward? What does that look like?
Yeah, so it could be done in a number of ways. So you could amend, you know, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913. You could also amend it in ways that, you know, are a little bit more subtle, increasing members, like the Democrats have talked about, increasing members of the Supreme Court. You can increase members of the Federal Open Market Committee. Currently, you know, you have, I think, 7 governors and 6 bank presidents that serve on that board. If you expand it and allow Trump to appoint new governors, and then obviously in spring of 2026, he has the right to appoint a new Federal Reserve chair. So if he gets to put in his chair, put in governors that are sympathetic to his viewpoint, I think he could do that. I think if Congress was behind this, you could amend it by law. I think that there's also certain things that the Treasury Department has at its disposal, which it has not used. It has this, as I mentioned, this special fund. It currently has, I think, it's called ESF. I forget exactly what it stands for. It's got 200 some billion in it currently. You know, these types of funds could be expanded by pulling cash from the Treasury General account. What Senator Loomis talked about in her Bitcoin Act was essentially extracting money from the Federal Reserve by demanding that the Federal Reserve revalue the Treasury gold certificates. So back when gold was around $42 an ounce, I think, the Federal Reserve took custody of the United States gold and gave the Treasury certificates that were valued at $42 an ounce. Loomis says in the bill that to pay for the Bitcoin Act, she's going to demand that the Treasury submit those certificates to the Federal Reserve Banks. Federal Reserve Banks need to issue new certificates at a market price of gold and then deliver the difference between that $42 an ounce and the market price in cash funds to the Treasury. And so I think there are ways without having Congress do it that you have the Treasury use extraordinary powers with which constitutionally it has but has not used that don't require an amendment of the Federal Reserve Act. But I think that could be on the table as well, especially if financial markets get to a point of crisis because of some of these, you know, volatile, these incidents that I think are going to spark this volatility.
What do you think it's sparked the volatility, like a liquidity crisis behind the scenes?
Yes, liquidity crisis, yields getting out of control, dollar getting out of control. In 2022, we had the dollar index at 114, and we had 10-year treasuries getting close to 5%. And obviously, when that happened, it triggered a lot of things. It triggered, you know, a lot of banks because they hold all these long-term treasuries that like their balance sheets are insolvent. You had Silicon Valley. So financial system instability. So, okay, let's say that you had government, you know, within the president's power, he's cutting spending. And then at the same time, you have, tariffs, which are causing, you know, different inflationary aspects, for example, or even supply shocks or goods that are tough to come by. You have all of these things that start happening that can also lead to dollar illiquidity. So, you know, you can have these countries that have been doing a lot of exports to the United States, not doing as many exports. They still need dollars because they're still working within the dollar system by and large. So how do they get those dollars? They start selling treasuries. This starts, you know, jacking up the dollar again, jacking up treasury yields. And again, these things start to become a spiral. And so there's more than a dozen ways that this financial instability can start to be sparked by some of these actions that the president is able to take simply by executive order. He has this broad tariff ability. He has the broad ability to cut government spending in different ways. So all of these things can start that chain reaction that then leads to the moment of crisis, that then leads to legislative will to make some of these dramatic changes, including possibly amending the Federal Reserve Act.
Mm-hmm. So in that scenario, is the Trump admin sort of wishing for this crisis to make these changes? Do the changes necessitate a crisis to justify the tectonic shift that could potentially manifest?
Mm-hmm. I think if Bessent understands, and I think he does, that there is a part of the global economic financial order that literally has gangrene. And it is a matter of, do we act now and put that tourniquet on and amputate, which is going to be bloody and painful and a horrible experience, or do we let the whole thing collapse and perhaps devolve into a real World War III? We're kind of in the middle of an economic World War III right now. Do we go into a hot World War III? Do we let the entire banking financial system collapse? If the system is really as fragile as I think it is, and that's the threat, then all of a sudden cutting off that leg, even though it's painful and causes this economic disorder and volatility. And I think, I mean, you look at these Morgan Stanley strategists and everybody, you know, a year ago I was out saying, look, we've got so much fiscal spending, we're going to have, you know, 6,000 on the S&P by the end of this year, probably 7,000 by the end of 2025. And all these, you know, big strategists were saying, oh, well, the economy's slowing and, you know, the Fed needs to cut and all this stuff. And now they're all saying, oh, you know, all these policies, it's just going to be amazing year for the stock market. You know, 7,000, people are trying to up it. Somebody just came out today, 7,007 as a S&P prediction for the end of next year. When you start getting all of this mass bullishness and everybody's thinking that everything is going up and to the right, I mean, that's really when you have to start being afraid. And so I've been very bullish on the stock market for a long time. And I'm now thinking about cutting back some exposure, buying puts, doing some things that I haven't really been doing for a while at the end of this year, early in January, because I think once Trump gets into office, he needs to move quickly. And some of these moving parts are going to be a little jumbled before we get to the other end of this. And that's where the volatility is going to be. But they're going to be willing to pay that price because they understand if they don't do something about it, it's just going to get worse, and there's no easy solution in sight.
How much of threading the needle do you think narrative is going to play into it? Like, is there a situation which you can imagine in which the Trump admin, I would imagine Bessent, on the tip of the spear here, saying, hey, we're about to take some harsh medicine. There's going to be some economic volatility and turmoil, but it is very necessary. Do you think that is needed to get through the other side? Because that's one thing that I'm sure the other side of the aisle will jump on immediately if it's not articulated and messaged appropriately by the Trump administration, is look what happened. You voted in Trump, he put in these tariffs, he's making cuts, and it's destroying the economy. Ha ha. This is what you voted for. And unless there's some articulate, motivated messaging that is sort of choreographing, hey, we're making these moves, there's going to be some turmoil, but we promise you on the other end, it's going to allow us to really set things back to a proper level, a sounder base, and then move forward with more with structural growth that is actually healthy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the toughest leadership challenge, you know, since World War II, is to lead the American people through something like this, through a jarring monetary reset that's going to have, you know, potential significant negative consequences. And it's going to require re-education, and it's going to require politicking, right? I mean, I think ultimately what the Trump administration will wind up doing is saying, look, it's the same thing with immigration. You know, there's probably going to be a video at some point of something horrible happening with mass deportations. I don't know what. God forbid, you know, migrants start deciding, well, if I get arrested in Texas, they're going to turn me over to ICE. I might as well start evading police. And a bunch of car chases happen and a six-year-old girl gets run over. You know, the left is going to jump on that and say, see what happens when you have Tom Holman and mass deportations. But why is that happening? Because they opened up the border and let in 20 million people, and we needed to do something in order to get these people out, right? And FDR did, you know, per capita, you know, it would have been 20, 30 million deportations. Barack Obama did millions of deportations. So, but these bad things happen, you know, when you're trying to fix things that are broken. And so, you know, I think he's going to have to say, look, there are, these bad things are not happening because I'm fixing this. These bad things are happening because this thing is so messed up that in order to fix it, you know, in order to fix your toilet, we had to turn off your water supply for a few hours. In order to fix the financial plumbing, you know, we're having to disrupt things. And don't blame me. Don't blame the Republican Party. Don't blame the MAGA people or America First, because we're doing the hard thing to make this country better and put us on a firm footing. You know, blame the money changers. Blame the easy Fed policy. Blame the over-Democrat spending. Blame the bloated social programs. This is what got us into this situation, and now we're having to fix it. And so, you know, if he can do that effectively, I think the American people, in some sense, for a while, have been looking for a purpose. You know, there's a little bit of a strength and struggle that sometimes occurs in people where, you know, kind of like after a Pearl Harbor event, whether you think it was kind of allowed to happen or not, whatever, it kind of galvanizes a population that really didn't want to have anything to do with World War II. But it's like, okay, now we need to do this, right? And I think there could be a moment like that where the American population realizes, hey, this really has gotten so out of hand. The only way to fix it is with pain. And Trump is the only person that can fix it. And we need to give him a little bit of leeway here, even if in the short term, it's not the most pleasant of experiences.
Yeah. And that's why I actually think the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve is top of mind for Trump, because you have to imagine, maybe it's not him individually, but people surrounding him and his administration have to recognize that Americans on a per capita basis own the most Bitcoin, and most of the Bitcoin wealth in the world, I believe, not most, but indexing for every country, I think the US is number one in terms of who owns the most Bitcoin on an individual basis. And so in terms of manufacturing a soft landing and using the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve as a variable and a tool on the way to that soft landing, I think that is a good calculated risk to take to basically ensure that you have a material percentage of Americans being protected because the price of Bitcoin's going up. And if that's happening, those individuals are going to be able to go out and reinvest in the economy and help rebuild things here domestically. I do, and it's not hand up. I'm a Bitcoiner. The show's about Bitcoin. I run a venture fund focused on investing in Bitcoin infrastructure. Talking my bag here, but outside of that, like outside of my bag and my personal incentives to push Bitcoin forward, I think removing myself from that point of view and just looking at this objectively, like it is a wise decision to lean into Bitcoin at this particular time, considering the strategic advantage that America has just due to the fact that so many Americans own a material amount of Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, what we're talking about too is these monetary instruments are about kind of securing, you know, resources, securing jobs, securing prosperity for people. And that we will get through this volatile period. And I don't think it's necessarily a super long volatile period. I think it could be a sharp period, kind of a shock to some people who think everything is going to be rosy for the next 12 months. But that I'm talking about a matter of months. Just like the COVID drop was like a 40, 50% drop in the market, and then it was back, that when we come out of this and the new Bretton Woods occurs or the new systems in place, that it's going to also be matched with real industrial policy. It's going, like, imagine there's yield curve control and interest rates are capped and we've got, you know, massive onshoring going on because of tariffs, and you know, everybody that wants a job can have a job, and wages are going up. Maybe there's a dollar revaluation here in terms of Bitcoin and gold, which is inflationary, but that dollar but that wages are going up more than inflation. Maybe inflation runs at 7-8%, but wages are going up 10-12%. You know, that benefits paycheck to paycheck Americans, and that's a big part of the Trump base. It doesn't necessarily benefit pension funds or insurance companies. But if you literally have $200 in your bank account and you're living paycheck to paycheck, if all of a sudden you get a 12% rise, but even though there's 7% inflation, but you got a 12% wage gain in the past 12 months, you know, you're doing better. And so there are ways to paint inflationary policies, resets, all these types of things where people start to understand, hey, this might not be great for corporate profit margins. It might not be great for treasury bond holders, but this is the right thing for America so that we can rebuild our manufacturing. We can regain our sovereignty. We can, you know, have a happy, thriving middle class where you don't need, you know, the mom and the dad working three jobs total, and they're still barely able to make ends meet and going into credit card debt at 23%. If we can get a country that looks more like, you know, a affluent middle class as the base instead of a super wealthy elite, as you know, spending, you know, trillions of dollars on, you know, Louis Vuitton bags, if we can move more back into that manufacturing base of a country, you know, I mean, this is going to be a great thing and ultimately great for the stock market. I mean, I could see the stock market going down to 4-something, 5-something on the S&P next year, but then winding up by the time, you know, 28 comes around at, you know, 15,000, you know, which might sound absolutely nuts, but in a devalued currency, you know, let's say we got a real doubling in the stock market. So it went from 6,000 to 12,000. And then because of inflation and, you know, earnings are priced in nominal terms, you add, you know, we could get some really crazy situations here with, you know, multi-thousand dollar advances in gold, Bitcoin, you know, who knows how many hundreds of thousands, and the stock market at 15,000, and you know, a job for every person who wants it in an economy that is leveraging the natural wealth, resources, innovation that America has, instead of having it being drained off in the financialization of America, which has happened for decades.
Yeah, I really like the idea of it being short too, and I think that could be messaged appropriately too. It's like, hey, we're going to make these stark changes. There's going to be some short-term turmoil. Maybe the next 6 to 8 months are going to be a bit shaky, but at the end of that period, we'll be reset. We'll be able to reset. The Great Reset is here. We'll be back at a structural, a sounder base from which we can grow. And I think tariffs, I mean, Trump joked about it, on his campaign trail. Tariffs is my favorite word. It'll become your favorite word too. And I think it's hilarious because it is becoming, I think people are becoming reacclimated with the way tariffs can be used. You have this overt tax on imported goods that American citizens do pay, but it creates this incentive to build the manufacturing base. But I think one thing about tariffs that many people underappreciate is just pure leveraging, the pure leverage that they provide the United States. And we saw an example of this yesterday. I mean, reports from Fox News that Trump met with Justin Trudeau and basically threatened him with tariffs, and asking Justin to justify why we're sending them $100 billion year in and year out, with that exchange not being reciprocal in terms of the value that we receive as a nation. I think the negotiating leverage that just threatening tariffs provides the United States is something that people need to better understand as well.
Yeah, that we're still the biggest boy on the block. And I mean, that's really what he's doing, right? He's moving away from these multilateral, international, intergovernmental organizations, and he's going at people kind of bilaterally. And in bilaterally, it's like there's no comparison, right? You know, what percent does the U.S. economy rely on Mexico, and what percent does the Mexican economy rely on the United States? And it's he's got the leverage. He knows how to negotiate. He has instincts that, you know, are off the charts, you know, and I think he just knows how to push people's buttons and get things done. And, you know, nobody's perfect. I mean, sometimes things backfire. I have some questions about some of his picks. I'm not somebody that thinks Trump is a saint and the next Messiah. You know, he's not a perfect person. He, you know, I'm willing to let him make mistakes. I'm willing to let him, you know, do whatever before I start, you know, turning on him and saying, oh my God, he's putting in deep state guys or whatever. You know, I'm willing to see how he's playing this because he's got a lot of balls in the air. You know, if he just didn't play any ball with the establishment, I mean, you start to create such a wall against yourself. You know, if you don't have a Marco Rubio in there, if you just have all Kash Patels, I mean, you're not going to get anything done. And so he's got to play the field, right? And so I think he's doing that. And I'm willing to give him that benefit of the doubt that he understands all these dynamics consciously or instinctually, and that's what he's putting in place. So, I mean, I'm positive about things. I'm positive, more positive than I have been, because traditionally I've been thinking that there's no way that we were going to do the gangrene amputation and the whole system was going to blow up and collapse. I thought it was going to happen sometime in 2027 or 2028, around the time the Social Security Trust Fund starts to go bankrupt, and, you know, that we're just going to continue on these massive deficits and that we're basically going to head for a financial total collapse. And I think we might have this, like you said, a short period of volatility with some pain, but a very quick V-shaped recovery that leads to kind of a brave new world that, you know, a lot of Americans get behind and could even turn into, you know, a longer period. You know, I think we could easily be looking at a 12-year period of MAGA type leadership in the White House, and similar to, you know, FDR being elected four times, being followed by Truman until finally Eisenhower, a Republican, got in there.
A new American Renaissance would be great. Yeah. I'm optimistic as well. And I completely agree. I think the harsh medicine needs to be taken. And that's what I'm most interested to see. And I think Scott Bessent was a good pick. And at the period of time when it was rumored to be Bessent versus Lutnick, Howard Lutnick, big in the Bitcoin space. Cantor Fitzgerald holds all the treasuries for Tether. He's publicly gone on podcast, says he owns hundreds of millions of dollars worth of Bitcoin, believes it'll be billions of dollars at some point in the future. And so many people are thinking, like, that's who you want as Treasury Secretary. But when it comes to tact and posturing, Lutnick seems more like a bull in a china shop to me compared to Bessent, who seems, I'm not going to act like I'm some Scott Bessent historical expert on everything he's done, but from the research I've done and the things I've read about him, he seems very calculated, cool, calm, collected, and methodical in terms of how he goes about effectuating the trades he's made historically. Or I think it's been very public that he's been in Trump's ear for the better part of 2 years in terms of fashioning his economic policy on the campaign trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And he talked in one of those podcasts, his largest position, gold. I think he'll need to come around a little bit on the Bitcoin idea. I think that's not his, you know, kind of starting place of seeing Bitcoin as a realistic monetary reserve asset for the United States. But I just think Bitcoin, and this is almost hard for me to say because I've traditionally, you know, been more of a precious metal guy, actually. I do own Bitcoin. I own gold. I own both. But, like, Bitcoin just checks so many of these boxes, not the least of which is that negotiating tool with BRICS, who have spent billions and billions of dollars buying gold in the last few years and just threatening to sell U.S. gold to buy Bitcoin. What that does to the Bitcoin price and does to the gold price, at least in the short term. As I said earlier, I think it would be a short-term dip in gold that this type of rhetoric would cause. But that, you know, these types of things are almost irresistible to a guy like Trump, I think, to throw out there as, you know, outrageous things that just, you know, can really get under the skin of some of these BRICS countries, which he's obviously not happy with.
Yeah. So how do you think people should prepare heading into inauguration?
Well, I mean, look, nobody has a crystal ball. I could be totally wrong. What I'm personally going to do, and I'm starting to do, is I want to lighten up on my risk. Not gold, not Bitcoin, because I don't know this gold sharp sell-off thing is going to happen. But my equity risk in particular, and have cash. I think traditionally the end of the year, people don't want to sell because of tax reasons. There's a whole bunch of reasons why we're probably going to go up into year end here in the last few weeks of the year. But I think that early in January, especially if I start seeing confirmations, like market starts struggling in January to make new highs, certain sectors that tend to lead heading into economic volatility start performing well, I'm going to be de-risking, building cash. And then I'm going to be looking for, like I said, that moment to pounce blood on the streets. I mean, who knows if Warren Buffett's seeing any of this? I don't know. I mean, obviously, he's got an oil tanker that if he wants to build cash, he's got to do it, years or months in advance. Maybe he sees something like this coming. I don't know. But I'm going to actually start raising cash, which I've been pretty much 100% fully invested, for a long time. And trying to get myself ready. So I think that's a good thing for people to do, especially if they have a large amount of equity exposure. And if they don't want to sell, at least maybe, buy some puts, because right now, I mean, volatility is low, protection's cheap. You don't want to start buying those things if the VIX starts spiking to 25 or 30.
Yeah. Mel, this was great. We got to do this more often. July 2nd. This will come out December. Say 3rd, 5th. It's too long. We'll have to catch up maybe at the end of first quarter next year.
Perfect. That'll give a chance to see if any of this is coming to fruition or if I'm going way off the deep end. And if I am going off the deep end, I'll be the first to admit it and say, hey, we're not seeing any of this. End of first quarter, I think we'll start seeing the ripplings of this. By the end of second quarter, I think we'll really be getting into the thick of it.
Awesome. Mel, appreciate you. This has been great. Where can people find out more about Quaz, about your theories? Because you joined Twitter after the last podcast, or you became more active on Twitter after the last podcast.
Yeah, exactly. I had never been a Twitter social media guy. I've worked 20 plus years in financial services, CEO of three different broker dealers, venture capital funded startups type things. And I wrote a book called Quaz. It's a financial thriller. It's about corrupt central bankers. It's about AI. It's about the blockchain. It's about Brazil and India and Russia conspiring to take down the dollar's reserve status. It's got a bunch of stuff in there that relates to what we talked about. So people can search Quaz financial thriller or go to my website, melmadison.com, or follow me on Twitter at melmadison1. I've been posting a little bit more. I'm not super active, but I'd never really posted anything until about 10, 12 months ago. And now I'm trying to do some more regular insights. Recently posted a piece on tariffs, why they can actually be free markets orientated, and how Adam Smith looked at it. So there's stuff up there if people are interested.
Go check it out, freaks. That's all we got today. Peace and love.
Thank you.